Neocatskill.
Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, science stories with Joe Johnson, former Port Jervis science teacher and Radio Catskill volunteer. Joe Johnson shares some science stories that caught his eye, including the emergence of volunteers who lived in a NASA-created Mars replica for over a year. Harmony in the Woods, Eddie 9V has made a name for himself in the blues scene in the South with his original retro soul songs. We'll chat with the blues and roots musician just ahead of his performance at the music festival this weekend. Plus, The Ripple Effect, a very New York City comedy at the Sullivan County Dramatic Workshop. And A River Valley, the latest group landscapes show at the Derby. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi speaks to the artists. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. NATO leaders are beginning a fresh day of work at their summit in Washington, D.C. Much of the focus is on Ukraine's fight against Russia. The Biden administration has announced the Dutch and Danish governments are now in the process of transferring F-16 fighter jets to Ukraine. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has asked NATO members not to wait for the outcome of the U.S. presidential election this fall to take a stand against Russia. NPR's Giles Snyder reports.
President Zelensky says the world is waiting to see what happens in November, but he said now's the time to step out from the shadows, and he called on American political leaders to be uncompromising.
In defending democracy, uncompromising against Putin and his coterie, uncompromising to every possible terror.
He spoke at the Ronald Reagan Institute, an apparent effort to appeal to Republicans whose presumptive nominee for president, Donald Trump, is famously a NATO skeptic, and his GOP supporters in Congress held up military aid for Ukraine for months. Giles Snyder, NPR News.
Extremely dangerous heat remains parked over nearly all of the western U.S. Forecasters say about 140 million people are under some kind of heat alert. This June was the second warmest ever recorded in the United States, according to federal climate data. NPR's Rebecca Hersher reports overnight temperatures broke records in many regions.
Average temperatures were well above normal in the U.S. in June, according to new data released by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA. Overnight temperatures are increasing more rapidly than daytime highs in most of the country, as climate change causes the Earth to heat up. And last month, NOAA estimates that about 24 million people in the West, South, and Northeast experienced the warmest overnight temperatures ever recorded for June. Rebecca Hersher, NPR News.
A Hezbollah rocket attack from Lebanon has killed two Israelis. Hezbollah says the attack was in retaliation for an Israeli strike that killed a Hezbollah operative. NPR's Daniel Estrin reports from Tel Aviv on the latest in 9 months of cross-border attacks in Israel and Lebanon.
The attacks Tuesday add to concerns about a wider war breaking out between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon. Hezbollah said an Israeli strike yesterday in Syria killed one of its operatives. The Associated Press identified him as a former bodyguard of Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah. In response, Hezbollah said it fired a barrage of rockets toward the Golan Heights, territory Israel controls since capturing it from Syria in 1967. Israeli authorities say a married couple, a man and woman, were killed when the rocket hit their car. The head of the Israeli local council in the area called on the government to wage war in Lebanon to eliminate the threat from Hezbollah. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
On Wall Street, stocks are higher. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 15 points at 39,307. This is NPR. A Senate committee is holding a hearing this morning on the response to the collapse of the Key Bridge in Baltimore last March. The bridge collapsed after a huge container ship struck one of its pillars. Six people were killed, and the port of Baltimore was temporarily closed. Vice President Harris took the Biden-Harris re-election campaign to Nevada yesterday. As NPR's Deepa Shivaram reports, the vice president highlighted a conservative policy roadmap being pushed by allies of former President Donald Trump, known as Project 2025.
Harris said Project 2025 would get rid of things the Biden administration has done, like capping the cost of insulin for seniors. The Biden campaign has been highlighting the policy wish list put together by the Conservative Heritage Foundation and authored in large part by former Trump advisors. Trump, for his part, has tried to distance himself from it. Harris said the Supreme Court's recent ruling granting broad presidential immunity makes Trump an even bigger threat.
Our last defense, our last line of defense is the ballot box.
The campaign says Harris will attend another event with Asian American voters in Philadelphia this weekend. Deepa Shivaram, NPR News, Las Vegas.
Former Republican presidential candidate Nikki Haley has released her presidential delegates. Nearly 100 delegates were pledged to vote for her at the upcoming Republican National Convention. She has urged them to now support former President Donald Trump. Haley was not invited to go to the Republican National Convention, but she says it is still a time for unity. When Haley withdrew from the presidential race, she did not initially throw her support to Trump. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Nature Conservancy, working across oceans and isles to cut carbon emissions, protect lands and waters, and support local communities for a future where people and nature thrive. Nature.org/solutions.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. It's our summer fund drive. We are on day three. We're about 20% of the way toward our $50,000 goal, and we need to hear from you if we haven't already heard from you. If we have heard from you, thanks. But if you're one of those folks that hasn't donated yet, call us at 845-482-4141 or go to wjffradio.org. And we're serious about fundraising, so serious that today, this morning, I brought out the big guns. It's culture reporter Valerie Manzi.
Oh, boy, here I am. I'm ready to go, folks. I mean, we are bringing you, like this morning, we have Joe.
Yeah, so we're coming up next, Science Stories with Joe Johnson, one of your favorite segments.
It's one of my favorite segments. And the wonderful thing about Joe is he picks unique ideas from out there that a lot of us might miss. But because he is a teacher and a good teacher, he explains it in ways that are not alienating and filled with jargon.
Yeah.
So if you want to expand your mind a little, go to Joe.
Yeah.
And we need your support, though, to keep Joe on the air.
Yeah.
845-482-4141. Or online at wjffradio.org. Do your part to keep these programs going.
Yeah, Science Stories with Joe Johnson. He's a former Port Jervis science teacher. He's a Radio Catskill volunteer, as Val mentioned. We'll get to his story this week in just a minute. But you're one of our volunteers as well, and you're culture reporter, Valerie Manzi. You've got a story coming up later this hour as well with the latest art talk and exhibit at the Derby,
yes,
right across the bridge from Narrowsburg coming up. And you are, as I, you know, as Joe and you do, you guys do this, you know, voluntarily. You bring these stories and, you know, report and talk to those people, you know, on your own accord because you want folks to know about it.
Absolutely. And I want to support the art community and the Arts Alliance and CAS and all of these great organizations that enable artists to exhibit their work and fund different projects. So a big thank you, and thank you to WJFF
for getting the word out there. Well, that's what we're here to do. We're here to be that platform to bring those stories from the community to everybody in the community. The only way we can do it is through your support, listener support. We're a nonprofit. We're a public radio station. We're listener supported. So that's how we are able to do it. And we need to hear from you during our summer fund drive so we can get to our total goal of $50,000 for this summer fund drive. 20% of the way there now. Call us at 845-482-4141 or go to wjffradio.org. You know, Val's stories and Joe Johnson's stories appear here on Radio Chatskill. So if you want to support them, go to the Radio Chatskill page and you can donate in support of the show, which supports, you know, their great work. You can make a comment there as well. And all of that goes toward the overall amount that we're trying to raise. So it's a great place to share your feedback about the great work that volunteers like Valerie Manzi and Joe Johnson do to bring this news and information to the community and keep you informed and inspired.
And one more thing, it is work.
Yeah, you're here a lot.
It is work. Well, the research,
the
keeping a production schedule, it's work.
It's
so.
Work, and you know, we're not paying you. Sometimes I'll give her a cookie.
Yes. which I greatly appreciate.
But again, it's because volunteers, dedicated volunteers like Joe Johnson and Valerie Manzi want you to know about these great things that are happening in our community and be
the
able
world.
To share that with you in the world as well. No matter how you're listening, on air, online, smartphone, smart speaker, you can hear it wherever and get that taste of the community wherever you happen to be. So pick up that phone that's probably in your hand or pocket, call us or go to the browser page there and type in wjffradio.org. If you're driving, don't call.
No,
hands-free,
don't.
Hands-free. But we would love to hear from you, especially now during our summer fun drive, 845-482-4141 or wjffradio.org. As we said, Joe Johnson is a former Port Jervis science teacher and a Radio Catskill volunteer. He shares science stories with us that caught his eye. Today, some of those stories include ants that can perform life-saving emergency surgery on each other.
Right.
And the four volunteers who spent more than a year living in a 1,700-square-foot space created by NASA to simulate the environment of Mars. They've emerged. Here's Joe Johnson speaking with Jason Dole.
First of all, the Mars crew habitat has emerged from their year-long isolation. So we're going to Mars eventually, and we need to train people. We need to learn about what it's going to be like on Mars. And so NASA and JPL, they want to study this. And so what they have done is they have created a simulated Mars habitat and environment called Mars Dune Alpha. Now, this thing is really interesting. It's actually a 3D printed structure, which is what they think they're going to try and do on Mars. It's in Johnson Space Center in Houston, Texas, along with basically a sandbox. They created this giant Martian surface they call the sandbox. And it's the CHAPEA is the name of the program, the Crew Health and Performance Exploration Analog. This was the first mission. There were four volunteer crew members, two men and two women, that entered the facility on June 25th, 2023, a little over a year ago, and emerged this past Saturday, July 6th. There was a commander, a flight engineer, a medical officer, and a science officer. And they wanted the simulation to be as close as possible to what it's going to be really like on Mars. Now, they can't simulate the space flight and weightlessness. But once they get to Mars, and by the way, this will apply to a lunar base as well, they seal everything in with them that they're going to need for the year mission, the food, their air, their water, their science supplies, everything. They run the mission on a 24-and-a-half-hour day because that's how long a day is on Mars. And once again, they're trying to make this as similar to Mars as possible. There's up to a 22-minute communications lag, so they can't just pick up the phone and call the people outside and say, hey, what do we do now? Because they're not going to be able to do that on Mars. There's a communications lag because it'll take time for the radio signal to get back to Earth and then for the answer to go back to Mars. But these folks in the lab had duties. They were doing some science. They were studying the behavioral aspects of the whole thing, maintenance of the habitat, etc. They carried out simulated Mars walks in the sandbox and in other places. They had VR simulations for driving Mars rovers. They grew, harvested, and ate hydroponically grown vegetables. And in fact, nutrition was like one of the biggest things that they were studying. They wanted to know how the nutrition that the astronauts were receiving would affect their performance, both behaviorally and physically. They actually experimented with 3D printed food. They had 3D printed pizza, which the picture was a little bit rough. So they, like I said, they were trying to study how they're going to behave, how their physical health would be maintained. So they collected a lot of data, and they're going to be studying it now. They just came out. There's been no the results that have been published or anything like that. And there are two more missions that are planned, two more year-long missions.
The simulation did not actually simulate the space flight, but did the duration of it take that into account? Was part of this year that they spent would have been equivalent to the time that they'd be spending in the travel, or are they really just simulating the duration and the activities of what they would be doing on the surface?
I think they're simulating what they're going to be doing on the surface. Because, no one's going to Mars and live there forever. They're going to go there. They're going to do their duty. They're going to come home. So I would guess, I didn't read this in any of the articles. I did read a lot of the original stuff. I'm not sure exactly why they chose the 1 year period, but it would seem that that's a logical period of time to stay.
All right. Next up, a little closer to Earth and often in the Earth, ants, they make up a big part of the biome. And you've got a story about how they're maintaining themselves, some ant maintenance.
Yeah. Yes, I do. So the team from University of Würzburg in Germany published in the journal Current Biology on July 2nd about these ants. They're actually Florida carpenter ants. Now, this same group had previously studied and reported on African ants that treat the wounds of nestmates with an antimicrobial solution that they secrete to avoid infection. It's very highly successful. It treats about 95% of the injured ants successfully. The secretions come from a metapleural gland, which is kind of on the back of their one of their sections, and they literally treat it. It's almost like we would put on bacitracin or something like that on a wound. They make this stuff. Now, Florida carpenter ants have no metapleural gland. It's just evolutionarily, it's been eliminated. And so the question that they had was, how do they treat their injured nestmates? And what they thought was that they would see amputation, and they were correct. Now, this amputation is practiced in a really highly skilled way. That's the interesting thing about it. They seem to know what will work and what will not. So the injured worker is going to present their leg to nestmates for treatment. You know, whether you're injured in the femur, which is the upper part of the leg, or the tibia, which is the lower part of the leg, makes a difference in how they're going to treat it. So they start licking it and inspecting it. If the wound is on the tibia, the lower part of the leg, the wound is going to be licked clean with none of the injured limbs being amputated. And the survival rates for tibia injuries improved from about 15 to 75%. In other words, they took ones that got injured and they were not allowed to be treated. They isolated them from the rest of the nest, and they had only about a 15% survival rate. Put them back in with the nest and let their nestmates clean them, and they had about a 75% survival rate. Now, if the wound is on the femur, the upper part of the leg, amputation is essential for survival. Once again, they took injured ants, and they took them out, that had been injured in the femur. They took them out, and they only had about a 40% survival rate. When they put them back in, when they allowed the nestmates to amputate the limb, they went up to about 90 to 95%. And what they did was it took them about 40 minutes to chew through the leg, for the nestmates to chew through the leg, while the injured ant just kind of stoically, that's the word they used, sits there and allows himself to be treated, or herself to be treated, I should say.
This works. This works for ants. Yes. Is this something that they think other types of ants are doing too?
It's never been studied in other ants, as far as I know, but I would guess that they are going to be studying it now. And the one I want to finish with here is, it's all about the infections. Why do they, you know, if it's in the lower leg, they don't amputate, but it's in the upper leg, they do amputate. And why is that? Well, in the lower leg, there's not a lot of blood circulation. Actually, it's called hemolymph. It's not blood. But there's not a lot of circulation. So if it does get infected, there's not a large chance that it's going to infect the rest of the body and kill off the ant. But in the upper leg, there's a lot of this hemolymph circulation. So if the damage happens up there, there's a high chance that it's going to be infected, and that will spread to the rest of the ant and kill the ant off.
It needs a more serious response. And the ants know. The ants know what to do.
They do. They do. This is, you know, instinct, evolution, whatever you want to call it. They know what their choices are here.
And finally, we've got a story about trilobite fossils. Everybody knows trilobites. I think even people that don't know that's what they're called will say, oh, yeah, I've seen that. I know what a trilobite is. But now there's even more to get to know with trilobites. This is amazing. Well, what's this about?
Trilobites are the second most recognized ancient organism besides dinosaurs, of course. Okay, they're an arthropod, which means they have an exoskeleton with jointed legs and segmented bodies, kind of like insects and spiders and crabs. Their closest relative to the trilobites, which, by the way, are extinct, is the horseshoe crab. Now, there were about 20,000 species that lived over about 270 million years. They went extinct during the Permian mass extinction, which was about 251 or 252 million years ago. So we had, you know, no human has ever seen a living trilobite, but they've been studied like crazy because their fossils are all over the place. The hard exoskeleton means that they're really well represented. Lots of people have found trilobite fossils. I have a ton in my collection at home. So the hard parts of the animal can only teach us so much about their anatomy. You know, they got a lot of soft, squishy parts. Think about a crab, you know, or a lobster. It's got the hard outer shell, but if that's all you ever studied, you wouldn't know a whole lot about the lobster. So in the June 27th issue of the journal Science, they talk about four trilobite fossils from two different species, which were found in the Atlas Mountains in Morocco. And they show amazing detail because of how they were preserved. All right. Normally when an organism dies, it, you know, sinks down to the bottom. It's covered up by sediments, and that fossilization tends to crush the organism and flatten it out. So you don't see it in 3D. You just see kind of a flattened part of it. Well, these four fossils, one of which was found in 2015, they realized what they had and they went back and found three more in 2021, are from the Middle Cambrian period, about 500 million years old. And the way they were fossilized was very different. Apparently, they were in very shallow water near a volcano that was erupting. And the pyroclastic flow with very hot ash settled onto the surface of the water. It cooled the ash and partially dissolved it so that as it sank, it encased these trilobites in very fine material. And because the trilobites actually ingested some of the ash, their digestive system was preserved as well. So the soft tissue was fossilized, which is just unheard of in these organisms. And one of the quotes says that it reveals exquisite details of the appendages and the digestive system. There's a lot of previously unknown anatomy that they didn't know. They didn't know what the mouth was like because it's all soft material and it would decay and it wouldn't fossilize. The digestive system, they realized that there's a central groove running down the bottom of the organism and it would actually pass food from the back to the front, kind of tearing it apart as it went. They found these little appendages that would do that, and then it was ingested into the mouth and it would go through the digestive system. They had never really gotten the antenna because they're soft parts, and they were able to see the antenna, small little leg bristles that were on the surface. And the cool way is how they saw inside these fossils, because normally when you see a trilobite, it's pretty flattened by, once again, the sediment crushing it down. Well, these are 3D fossils. So they used X-ray microtomography, which is basically a CAT scan, a micro CAT scan, to actually see inside these critters, which were 500 million years old. That's the thing that blows my mind, that they are 500 million years old and yet preserved in just this amazing detail. They're going back. They're trying to get Morocco, the government, to protect the site. It's up in the Atlas Mountains, but it's an unprotected site right now, and they're trying to get them to, because they want more. And what they're wondering is, what other organisms were there that were preserved in this way? And around the world, what other organisms might have been preserved in this way?
While you're talking, Joe, I looked this up, and I'm actually looking at one of those microtomographic reconstructions. This is phenomenal. Never seen a trilobite look like this. Yep. So you owe it to yourself to check it out online and see for yourself. But in the meantime, Joe, I will say thank you so much for keeping us updated on the latest science news.
My pleasure as always.
Joe Johnson, a science teacher and Radio Catskill volunteer, speaking to Jason Dole about some science stories that caught his eye this week.
Interesting facts about tribolites.
Trilobites.
Trilobites.
Tribolites.
I always say it right. I've always called them tribolites.
I thought I felt old.
Yeah. Anyway.
It's our summer.
Anyway, great job, Joe.
Good job, Joe. It's our summer fun drive, and Valerie's here. She's got a story coming up we're going to hear a little bit later about the latest artist talk at the Darby Hotel just across the bridge there in Narrowsburg. But when we come back, we're going to preview the next play that's opening up at the Sullivan County Dramatic Workshop, right here on Radio Catskill.
Hi, I'm Valerie Mamsey. I report on local arts and culture for Radio Catskill. And talking with these creative people keeps me up to date on current trends. For instance, this summer, all the cool people are supporting public radio. That's right. The in thing is to keep the radio on. Don't miss out. Be cooler than ever this summer by keeping Radio Catskill on air. Give now at WJFFradio.org.
Valerie Mansi, you're the coolest. Thanks for doing that promo for us.
You are welcome.
And she's got it right. It's our summer fun drive. Be cool. Give now. 845-482-4141 or go to WJFFradio.org. Make a donation. Help us get closer to our goal. This is Radio Chatskill. I am Tim Bruno, joined in the studio by culture reporter Valerie Manzi. Valerie, you lived in Manhattan or you?
Yes.
Yeah. So you might be familiar with some of these things, that, are occurring in this play that's opening up at the Sullivan County Dramatic Workshop this Friday.
Okay.
Acrobatic positions, a nosy Jewish Wiccan neighbor, a skeptical Catholic scientist husband, pickles, the New York Times Sunday crossword, and a black and white from Zabar's.
A black and white from Zabar's.
That's the one. I was going to say, maybe not the other ones, but this is all some Manhattan goodness, part of a play. It's a comedy, as you may have guessed, called The Ripple Effect, which opens Friday at the Sullivan County Dramatic Workshop. I spoke to Harold Tai from SCDW about this very NYC show.
Right. Ariana Rose is a native New Yorker who now has relocated to Florida. And a couple of years back, we did a 10-minute play of hers called The Ripple Effect. And she's extended it to a full-length play now. And it is a very, very, very funny play about a New York City couple who lives in an apartment about the size of three bathrooms. And their nosy neighbor who, well, I won't give away the secret, but it's the three of them. And Jeff and Amy are trying to get pregnant and stay pregnant. And so all the things that you go through when you're a fairly young couple trying to have your first baby.
And this is played for comedic effect, you said.
Oh, absolutely. It's rolling the aisles funny in places.
How did this come about being developed? You said it was a shorter version. Now it's more a full-length version. Was this something that the author brought to you or something you guys requested or collaborated on?
I got an email from Ariana in the spring and said, look, I know you did this play before, the 10-minute version, and I've extended it to a full-length version. And we had to replace a play that we could not cast. And so this one came across my desk at just the right time and place. And I called her and said, we'd love to do it. I later found out that we are going to be the very first full production of the play. So it's a world premiere, technically.
Uh-huh.
And but it's very funny. And it's written with a very New York perspective, New York City perspective, that is. Lots of witty humor, lots of I didn't see that coming kind of stuff. And it's just been a joy to work with us. And as a matter of fact, she came up from Florida. She's here this week to see opening night on Friday. And she's going to be doing a talk back after our Sunday performance, the 2:00 matinee on Sunday.
Does it have sort of a throwback to some classic Broadway comedies?
It tends to have that flavor, but it's set today. The two of them never leave their cell phones. The couple across the hall, Mrs. Teitelbaum and her husband, are classic New York City, apartment building neighbors. And, they know everything and everybody in the whole building because they lived there since, Lincoln was president kind of thing. And so it really has a New York flavor, but it's kind of a universal theme. The things that a young couple goes through, when you're having your first child. And as I worked through directing the play, I remembered going through all of this when, Lillian and I had our first child. So, and it's like, old home week for me. So
you are also having a performance on July 14th. That performance will benefit the literacy volunteers of Sullivan County.
Right. For the last, this would be the third year in a row. Of course, I teach a math class over at the Literacy Center, and my wife is on the board at the Literacy Center. And so what we've done for the last, this will be the third year in a row, is one of our plays, we do a benefit performance. So on Sunday the 14th, we do our regular 2 o'clock matinee, and then at 7 p.m. we're doing a benefit performance for the Literacy Volunteers of Sullivan County. And the proceeds, all of the proceeds from that performance will go to the Literacy Center. Last year we raised a little over $600. We're hoping to do a little better than that this year. So if you're a supporter of the Literacy Center and all the good things that they do between their GED programs and the bookstore and the support that they give to the local schools and both school-age children and also to adults in continuing their education. And Sunday night at 7 o'clock is the place to be, is the Rivoli Theater in South Fallsburg.
And then after this cute couple comedy from New York, you guys are going to go off to see The Wizard. The Wizard of Oz is the next production coming up.
Yes, The Wizard. We're gonna do up the town with the yellow brick road and all the characters you come to know and love in The Wizard of Oz. The wizard and the munchkins and the winkies and the flying monkeys and the witches and the scarecrows and everybody else. And we've got a very diverse cast for that. And we're looking forward to that. They've been rehearsing since around mid-March, and they're just itching to go.
Well, we're looking forward to that coming up this weekend, The Ripple Effect at the Sullivan County Dramatic Workshop. There's more information at scdw.net. We've been talking to Harold Tai from Sullivan County Dramatic Workshop. Break a leg. Thanks so much.
Thank you. See everybody on the boards.
And we're going to take a quick break and come back with culture reporter Valerie Manzi's story, the latest artist talk, artist exhibition also going on at the Darby Hotel called A River Valley.
Right.
So many great things going on culturally in our area.
We are lucky.
Height of summer. We'll bring you some more of that right after this break.
Last year, over 100,000 people died from drug overdoses driven by fentanyl. And the fastest growing group is under 19. Fentanyl is the number one cause of overdose in Sullivan County. Whether you're a parent or an educator, you can have the right conversation now to potentially save a kid's life. Protect kids from the dangers of fentanyl. More information and resources at naturalhigh.org. Paid for by Catholic Charities of Orange, Sullivan, and Ulster.
Radio Catskills Summer Fund Drive is happening now. We need to raise $50,000 in just 13 days, and you can help us do it in less time than that. We're accepting donations now, right now, at wjffradio.org. We're already on the way to reaching our goal. Help make that happen. Give what you can. Give now. Call a friend and ask them to give too. Just make your donation at wjffradio.org and you'll be cool for the summer. Thanks.
Cool for the summer. Yeah, donate at 845-482-4141 or wjffradio.org. We're 20% of the way toward our goal on day 3. Pacing okay, Valerie Manzi.
Yes.
But we need to get closer and maybe get to that goal of $50,000. Before July 20th.
Wouldn't that be wonderful?
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, my goodness. Yes, we would really love that.
We would love that.
And if you donate, you'll get the prettiestly designed thank you note. Thank you for being cool. What a lovely design that is.
Well, you know, we do our best over here because we've got great supporters.
I donated, so I'm going to take one home and
put it on my desk. We'll send you one.
And enjoy it. And so if you want to get a thank you note that's beautifully designed and colorful and, of course, cool, you can call 845-482-4141 or online wjffradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno in the studio with culture reporter Valerie Manzi. And Valerie Manzi brings us a lot of arts and culture in the region. You've got a story for us today, a segment with a couple of artists who are exhibiting at the Darby Hotel just across the bridge from Narrowsburg there. The show is called A River Valley, the latest group landscape show featuring 9 different artists. And the challenges of what the idea of landscape is.
Absolutely.
And who are you speaking to today?
I am speaking to Nathaniel Udell and Crystal Groh.
And Nathaniel showing his photographs of invasive species in the show. We had an invasive species segment yesterday.
Well, he has a different perspective on
yeah,
it.
Yeah, okay.
So it's really interesting.
Cool. And we're going to hear that next with Crystal, who's showing her photography of roadside America. Here's culture reporter Valerie Manzi.
Good morning, Crystal and Nathaniel, and welcome to WJFF Radio Chatskill.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
It's wonderful to see both of you. And Nathaniel, I've known for some time, mm-hmm. and Crystal is my first time meeting you.
Yeah,
so
hi.
This is nice. And it was interesting, as we spoke before we started recording, you are both musicians and mm-hmm. you're both artists. So that is a nice compatibility mm-hmm. to have for this show. And we'll talk about the artist talk you'll be giving, and that is this Thursday, July 11th at 6:30 p.m., and it is at the Darby Hotel right across the bridge from Narrowsburg, and you'll be speaking about your work that's part of ongoing exhibit through the end of August called A River View. And it's landscape show, which the art varies from traditional to abstract. So, Crystal, tell me a little bit about the work you'll be having in the show.
Sure. So I am a photographer, and I work with film, sort of a strictly analog photographer. But I've been photographing sort of various things in the landscape genre for a really long time, but it wasn't until I was asked to be a part of this show that I really started thinking about my work as part of a landscape tradition, which has been so helpful and really kind of eye-opening to me, because I always knew what I didn't like to take photos of. You know, I'm not a street photographer. I don't really like portraiture, but I'm really attracted to sort of things that present themselves in the landscape that are part of like the built environment and this like modern industrial sort of world we've built around us. So I was always photographing, you know, interesting buildings, but it's not architecture. It's how those buildings are placed within the larger landscape. So being a part of this show really clarified a lot of that for me. And it's been really exciting to actually start thinking about my work as part of kind of a larger tradition and how I can be looking at that from a new perspective. And that's been really exciting for me.
Oh, it sounds exciting. I'm getting excited to see it. Do you have a website?
I do. So my sort of it's kgreyscale.com. Kgreyscale. Some folks may recognize that from a grayscale darkroom and photo lab, which was an operation I used to run up at the Narrowsburg Union, which was all analog photography and film processing and darkroom stuff. So the analog process is really, really, it's really important to me, and it's a really important part of my work as well. So grayscale darkroom and K grayscale is kind of my, that sums up, that's my my alias, my photography alias.
Okay. And Nathaniel?
Yeah, well, the work I have up at the Darby it's a collection of photographs of invasive and exotic species of plants that I found on my property. There was a time with my work where it's like I would wander endlessly through the woods with a very big camera and make black and white photographs. And at some point, I felt that the work wasn't asking good enough questions. And I made a big transition. I started photographing office plants, starting to think about constructed landscapes and kind of this idea of nature as we actually experience it. At that time, I was working a lot in offices. And I was like, I'm spending more time around plants than I'm around trees. And so this work, they're still lives, and they're intended to imitate botanical drawings really from the 1800s and think about that when you look at a landscape, you know, obviously you take it in, you enjoy it, but it's very much constructed, whether you're thinking about environmental laws and regulations, forestry management, the fact that, you know, the majority of the U.S. has been clear cut. It's not old growth forest. And that even the flowers that you see blooming that you're enjoying, they were in many cases brought here for specific economic purposes. And so really trying to understand more of the history of the property that I live on, you know, that it's like, well, it's been agricultural, obviously, and it, there's been trees taken from it and it was a boarding house. And so there's all these different things. But then there's also plants that are there because maybe they were brought over as ground cover to because they were good crop food, that they have a lot of different purposes. And so really trying to look at the aesthetics and the difficulty of kind of bridging that gap between what's nature and what's not, and how do you experience it and how does it make you feel?
And what did you discover that really stood out to you?
What I think was most surprising was the size of the plants. Some of them are incredibly small. Years ago, I spent some time with a group of botanists surveying some sites and seeing how they would work, how they would pick a marker, and then they would try and inventory every plant that was within maybe 10 yards or 10 feet of that marker, and they would come back repeatedly. And so to see them really like picking through, and I found these, I found these little things. They look like orchids almost, but they're tiny, you know, they're like less than half an inch, but they're invasive. Someone brought them. Someone made that choice and said, we need this plant here because it's going to solve a problem.
I think I've seen that plant.
Oh, I'm sure. I mean, there's nothing – what I have growing on my property certainly is not unique.
Oh, yeah.
But it's realizing the scope and the shape of these changes. The trees are really obvious.
Yeah.
But when you find little tiny plants in your lawn
– We have a section of little tiny plants that are the prettiest little things.
Right.
That one looks like an orchid.
So it's unexpected. I think some of the scale of it, that someone actually made the choice to import that.
So this is certainly not a traditional landscape art show, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think what's interesting about both of our work, as we were kind of talking about it, is it is talking about landscape, but we're both kind of talking about choices and sort of intentional decisions that have been made to actually manipulate the landscape, where the traditional landscape photography is very much about, it's much more documentarian. It's sort of capturing nature as it is and kind of giving a sense of grandeur and beauty to this kind of undisturbed natural wonder. But like, that's just not really the world we live in anymore. And I think both of our work is really trying to acknowledge that from both like a micro and a macro perspective. But I think it is, the show itself is really, really varied and is kind of asking a lot of those big questions about what is landscape. And especially in an area like this where we are so lucky to be surrounded by such beautiful nature and landscape, but it's also an opportunity to kind of think critically about what that is and what our impact as human beings is on the landscape and how that's reflected in the plant life, in the buildings and the architecture and the atmosphere and how we interact with that landscape now. And what we leave behind. I think that's something I really think a lot about in my work too, is, you know, this idea of monuments and sort of landmarks and the things that you visually identify with a place to sort of know where you are, and the things that are left behind so future generations will look back on it to build a story about what this moment in our life was like. And what we're going to have are run down movie theaters and sort of old burnt out gas stations. And, you know, those are the relics, you know, that's what we're leaving behind in our landscape. And that's something that has become really, really clear to me in the last couple of years and couple of months thinking about this work and my work in this show.
So it's a very expansive view of landscape.
Yeah.
And
definitely.
Really is provoking thought for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I think so. I was going to say there are 9 different artists in this show, and we all, both in media and in approach, are very diverse. So it makes for, I think, a really rich experience in terms of, you know, how do you experience landscape? What do you bring to it? What does it give to you?
Wonderful. Well, this is all very exciting, and you're going to be speaking Thursday the 11th at 6:30 at the Darby across the bridge from Narrowsburg. Is there anything else you want to add?
Well, I mean, I know that there will be drinks and snacks.
Okay, good.
Um, Yeah, and I think it's just, I would definitely encourage people to come out to see the work if you haven't seen it already. Mm-hmm. But I think it's always nice to have an opportunity to hear from the artists about the work, especially in a show like this that includes so much sort of variety. Yeah, so I would say, what else on a Thursday night? What better way to spend the time? So come out and experience some local art, meet some local artists, and sort of see what they're thinking about this kind of big, broad topic of landscape.
Well, it does sound very inviting, to be sure. Mm-hmm. And I know the other artists talk at the Derby were all quite wonderful. And not dry, very mm-hmm. energetic, funny, upbeat. Mm-hmm. It's a very lovely experience and a great sharing with the community.
Yeah. Well, we're very lucky to have such a vibrant and mm-hmm. interesting arts community here mm-hmm. and people that want to support it. And, you know, Judy and Randall and Somewhere Co. have done such a good job of curating this show and of making it that kind of dynamic, energetic place to sort of see and show work and hear from people about what they're doing. So.
Yes, and we at WJFF are grateful for you, too, and that's why we devote time to covering the arts. It's a labor of love, let's face it.
It's true.
Of course, it always is.
Right. Okay, well, thank you so much for taking the time to come in and visiting our studio, and I look forward to seeing you on Thursday.
Oh, great. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And that's culture reporter Valerie Manzi, and she's joining me live in studio now.
Yes,
thank you
yes.
for that. And thank you for bringing us all different types of arts and culture. You don't just specialize in one particular area.
No,
you'd like to go to different locations absolutely. And different mediums of people to mm-hmm. be, you know, more well-rounded, not only for you, but for our listeners as well.
Yeah, well, you know what I'm going to say is we're here for you, listeners. And, you know, we're here to support you, so we're going to ask you to support us
yeah.
at 845-482-4141 or, of course, online at wjffradio.org. We cannot do it without you.
No, we're listener-supported public radio. It's our summer fun drive, and we need your support. We're asking you to be cool and donate right now. Speaking of cool, we have a really cool artist coming up next, a musician, Eddie Ninevolt, who's playing at Harmony in the Woods. We're going to talk to him live next on Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Willow Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange and Sullivan, a publicly supported philanthropic institution, CFOSNY.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
It can be hard to let your mind wander sometimes, to learn about something new, or to get fully engrossed in somebody else's story. That's where NPR comes in.
It takes a long time to create a fairy tale.
He was both a Jesuit priest and a jazz manager.
As soon as I saw the subject, I thought, oh my God, this is it.
Invest in deep, human storytelling today by giving to this station.
Give now at WJFFradio.org.
Or give us a call, 845-482-4141. Donate during our summer fun drive to get us to our goal in record time, hopefully before the deadline we've set for ourselves, July 20th. We could do it sooner if we hear from you, 845-482-4141 or WJFFradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill, and Harmony in the Woods hosts regional and national performing artists of all genres all summer long in Hawley. All his life, Eddie Ninevolt has acted on instinct. He is a self-proclaimed old soul artist. He turned away from the path of college and jobs to burst all guns blazing onto the blues club circuit of his native Atlanta. He'll be at Harmony in the Woods Saturday. Here he is performing Saratoga.
Where does the time go when you're all alone? Don't I feel like space and time? I don't want to poach, can just chill all night. Everything you wonder's what's wrong or right.
And Eddie Nienvold is joining us live on the phone right now. Eddie, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Tim. How you doing, man? Thanks for having me.
Hey, we're doing great. You're sounding really good. As you said, you're a self-proclaimed old soul artist. And the interesting thing I found out about you in some research was that you picked up your first guitar at age 6. And not only that you were young and picked up that guitar, but you kind of ignored the whole pop scene at the time and studied some older musicians, right?
Oh, that's correct, man. I was never really into whatever was on the top 40 radio, that's for sure. I got my first guitar at 6, and I was in every type of band from folk to 50s rock to metal music. It's been kind of crazy.
What was it about these older artists? You mentioned Muddy Waters, Freddie King, Howlin' Wolf. What was it about them that attracted you to their sound and their style?
I don't know. It was just something, when everything was being, pushed down our throats with Beyonce and stuff like that, which they're all great in their own way. Something about the old music of like Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf, it just always intrigued me. And it's just something I've never heard of. And I've always just been chasing that sound since.
And then when you were 15, you, instead of, working toward a path to college or jobs, you went right into the blues and club circuit in Atlanta, which is pretty vibrant. How was that for a teenager?
Oh, it was amazing. Honestly, I knew I was never going to go to college. I never really had the academic smarts of even like my brother. But I decided to call a few venues, and I actually had to lie about my age a little bit a few times. But I just got into the clubs that way, man.
Yeah, and then flash forward to 2019, you had your debut album, Left My Soul in Memphis, which inspired by Memphis rock and blues. You said that was a side project that ended up taking off?
Yeah, it was actually, we started this band as a band because we were in another band at the time, but we were kind of just playing like original shows and, not really selling tickets and just kind of playing around regionally. But we started this band to kind of play in the clubs and, go make $500 to $600 at these little bar and taverns in Atlanta. And it took off.
I got to ask you about the name, Eddie Nienvold. How did you come up with that moniker?
It's funny. I was told they wanted me to use my real name, which isn't my real name. It's actually my middle name. They wanted me to do a Brooks Mason Blues Band. And I just did not want to be on a moniker of, just a Joe Schmo Blues Band. I didn't want to typecast myself either. So we just kind of came up with the name Eddie. And I use a lot of guitar pedals, so we just said, which require 9-volt batteries, so we just said Eddie 9-volt, and it stuck.
We talked about some of your influences of blues giants that you were inspired by and studied, but want to talk about somebody in your family that also inspired you in terms of songwriting, your Uncle Brian. Tell us about your Uncle Brian's influence on your songwriting and style.
Man, Uncle Brian's influence is, it goes a long way, man. He was the one that would get our families together every week, not every week, probably, once a month, and we'd have a party. And, I was too young to drink or anything like that. So I was just, having fun and watching him play. And I was a drummer at the time. And it was just amazing to watch him just come up with all these lyrics on the spot and just come up with all these songs. It was truly amazing.
That's very cool. And it was you mentioned also that your family fish fries as well. So there's some good food going on.
That's
too.
Right.
Yeah, you guys are on tour. How's it going so far on the summer tour schedule?
It's been great. We did a lot of shows earlier this year. And we're actually, we did a bunch of kind of like weekend stuff. And we've been flying in and out. But we're actually picking up the other members in the van in downtown Atlanta as we're speaking right now. And we're going to hop on the road. And, we got a lot of shows coming up. And we're going all the way out to California, basically from the East Coast to the West Coast. We're really excited.
And you'll be at Harmony in the Woods in Hawley, Pennsylvania this Saturday, playing outdoors in the middle of the beautiful scenery there. And you're out behind the new album, Little... I've lost the name of it. I'm sorry. It's Little Black Flies.
not Little Fires Everywhere. That's the name of a TV series, I think, in book, Little Black Flies. That is your current album. And tell us a little bit about this record and what's going on with your music in this particular spot.
Well, you know, Little Black Flies is a nice little blues album we produced, and we wanted to produce it in a way that it was, you know, like old style records. And, you know, we all wanted to be live in the studio. And so, yeah, it's a very fun record to listen to, man. It sounds like a party.
Cool. We'll play it out as we say goodbye. But thanks for being here with us today, and looking forward to you at Harmony in the Woods in Holly on Saturday. More information about Eddie at eddie9volt.com. Eddie, thanks for being here this morning, and have a great show in Holly.
Thank you guys so much for having me, and y'all have a wonderful week, and we'll see you there.
All right, we're going to play it out with some... Well, that's more Saratoga. Sorry about that. But that's Eddie 9 volts. Thank you, Eddie, for being here. My technical prowess is not very good this morning. Val Manzi is still with me. Val, Eddie 9 volts. Some really great tunes there.
Yes, wonderful. And we're bringing it to you so that you know about it. And if you can get there on this Saturday, correct?
Yeah, there's a lot going on this week, summer. But you know what? We love to be able to show you everything that's going on, or a lot of things, not everything. But we try to give you a flavor of everything. And great to know that we've got these great regional theaters and performance spaces that attract these really nationally known artists and specialists in their area. Like, he's a really well-known and great blues performer. And so very cool to have them in our backyard.
That's right.
And you're bringing us the folks that are, you know, doing their art and the medium at the
That's
River
right.
Gal-
and theater. There's theater coming up this weekend in Roscoe and in Lake Huntington.
Yeah, check out the community calendar at WJFFradio.org for a list of what's going on. And if you want to get on that list and you're a nonprofit and you have not been on our community calendar, send a email to calendar@wjffradio.org. And while you're at the website, you know what you could do?
What?
You could donate. Why, Val?
Why?
Because it's our summer fun drive.
Yes. And we want you to be cool.
We want you to be cool.
Especially in this heat. Be cool.
Well, this is perfect timing to stay inside and listen to a little bit of radio, Radio Catskill, bringing you the latest of news and culture and NPR. So donate to support that, 845-482-4141, or go to WJFFradio.org. If you've donated already, thank you so much. If you're a sound supporter, thank you so much. We rely on our sound supporters so greatly. If you're not either one of those, then please donate and become one of those, 845-482-4141, or go to WJFFradio.org. Help us meet that goal. We're listener-supported, nonprofit, public radio, and we're only here because of our listeners. We rely on our listeners.
Yes.
You make this this station possible. You help keep the community inspired. You help keep the community informed. Your support helps you know, pay for the bills. The
That's
lights
right.
are on because of you. 845-482-4141 or WJFFradio.org. Valerie Manzi, a delight to have you live in the studio across the way. Thank you so much. I know we have some more events coming up this week that you'll be reporting on tomorrow and Friday.
Absolutely.
We
look forward to those. Stay tuned.
All right. That's all for this edition of Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from The Furniture Restore, located on Main Street in Jeffersonville, specializing in antique and vintage furniture, rugs, art, and lighting. Because buying well-made and pre-owned is a better choice for the planet. Online at therestorejville.com. And from The River Reporter, the community newspaper serving four counties along the Delaware River in Pennsylvania and New York. RiverReporter.com. And from listeners like you.
Radio Catskill's Summer Fun Drive is happening now. We know it's a busy time of year. It's hot. There's a lot going on. That's why you should stick with Radio Catskill, because we're cool for the summer.
Cool for the summer.
We've got local news, culture, and NPR. What's cooler than NPR?
OMG, it's the coolest.
Come on in. The radio's fine. Make your donation at WJFFradio.org, and you'll be cool for the summer.
Cool for the summer.
stay cool with us and help us stay cool with your donation, 845-482-4141 or WJFFradio.org. It's our summer fun drive. Support us now. Speaking of staying cool, today's weather, there's a heat advisory in effect until 8 again. Some unsettled weather, as you can probably tell here. Warm and humid, some sun this morning, but a couple of heavy afternoon thunderstorms possible. Some of those storms could be so severe that they bring some flooding or damaging winds. Again, tonight, a couple of heavy showers and thunderstorms. This is all a result of tropical rainstorm Beryl moving up through our area. Again, some of those storms this afternoon and tonight could bring some flooding and damaging winds. Keep an eye out on that. Tomorrow, cloud, sun. Hey, get this, not as warm. High of only 80, a little humid still. And we will keep you informed on all of the weather here at WJFF Jeffersonville, Radio Catskill. It's 11 o'clock.